This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice for the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at KABF.org, WAMF.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and at chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today we're talking to Professor Kenneth Reardon, who's written a very interesting book called Building Bridges, Community and University Partnerships in East St. Louis. Ken is a professor and director of urban planning and community development at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Welcome to Wade's World, Ken.
Delighted to be here. Good morning.
Well, and lucky to be here from Boulder, I heard. So I've known Ken for a long time. I could have interviewed him about our Katrina book years ago. He was a hero in Katrina, but What brought you to write this book, Building Bridges, Community and University Partnerships in East St. Louis? This is Wayback Machine. What's up here?
Sure. Back in the late 1980s, many American cities were devastated by the loss of factories, their economic base. People moved out. And in many older industrial cities, urban scholars didn't think there was much of a future. One of those places that was hardest hit was East St. Louis, Illinois, a fantastic, once vibrant riverfront town, which lost its complete economic base and over half its population. As the city began to lose its ability to deliver services, a group of 8 African-American women got together, inspired by the memories of the Civil Rights Movement, and they created a grassroots movement to try to restore their town one block at a time. And I had the good fortune of working with them for 10 years. And this book is really about their story.
Because you were up the road at that time, right? This was about 25 years ago, and you were then at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. Is that correct?
Yeah, which was the state university, but located, as you said, 200 miles away. And their state representative had gotten a request from these folks for planning and design assistance, and I was a young professor then, hard to believe, and was invited to go down and to meet these folks. And I was just in awestruck by what they had managed to do. They reached out, they pulled together 10 churches, a local settlement house, began cleaning up vacant lots, began to build small vest pocket parks. And within 10 years of this partnership, the work rose to the level of new housing construction. And then the most significant thing, they were able to hold up the original early planning for a light rail line that was going to serve St. Louis Airport and come just down to the river's edge in St. Louis and not cross the river, serving the poorest portion of the region. And these 8 women mobilized their base with the university supporting them. We challenged the Metrolink plan, and the ultimate outcome was an extension of the Metrolink by 11 miles, which gave, for the first time, very, very poor people in East St. Louis who didn't have access to private cars the ability to get to living wage jobs, and that created the basis upon which there could be new housing development. All of this was a prairie fire led by these 8 African-American women inspired by the great...
Let's talk about one of them, because if there's a hero or a heroine in your book, Cleola Davis is a name that comes up over and over and over again in the index, and if you read the book, and she was sort of a spark plug for this whole affair, wasn't she?
Absolutely, and she grew up in as a young woman in the first public housing complex in East St. Louis, Gompers Homes. She watched on a scratchy black and white TV the early civil rights work of Robert Moses and Fannie Lou Hamer, and she got inspired to embrace citizen work, community work. She went to work for a local settlement house, never rose in the hierarchy of that institution, but when people ran into trouble, she's the person that they called. Very quickly, she realized that putting Band-Aids on individual families who were suffering loss wouldn't really change the futures and trajectories of young people in her community. And she became a self-trained organizer and began pulling institutions together to challenge policies in the city. She became a member of the St. Clair County Democratic Organization. She tried to be a voice for low-income people of color in that region. And she was the person who pulled together these local institutions and then ultimately got the university involved. And none of the development that happened in the city would have been possible without her prophetic voice and leadership. She was a courageous woman with a phenomenal sense of humor and a deep, deep commitment to social justice.
And the other seven women, you mentioned there were eight, were they single mothers? Were they on welfare? Were they also people working for, you know, community institutions, or were just people who had worked with Ms. Davis in the past?
They were her neighbors. And, you know, when she needed extra hands on deck, these are the people who showed up. One was the head of the local neighborhood association, which had a very limited membership until Ciola helped them grow it. Another woman was with her husband starting a small vending business, putting sandwiches in workplaces so folks had some options for nutritious food. A couple of others were single moms at home who worked part-time at the daycare facility in the neighborhood. But they were facing a situation where good jobs were disappearing, access to basic services like food and health care disappearing, the local hospital closed. And they realized that they needed to do something. Their local government was incapable at that point of providing a spark, a direction. And these women decided, you know, after doing a series of small projects, that they were up to it. As they say in the Black church, they felt able, and they were. Our students who got a chance to work with them were obviously transformed by their optimism, their commitment, their courage, and their wonderful sense of humor. And many
we
of those
say in organizing that an organizing committee is as key as that central leader, and it looks like they had one. What was that her particular neighborhood like?
Well, at one time, it was the home of the Packing House Workers of America, the CIO organizing committee. It was just across the town line from a stockyard center, sort of like the stockyards of Chicago. It was a spot market for pork, beef, mules, et cetera. It was a meat packing center. Armor Company had a big production facility there. And when those companies closed in the late 60s and early 70s, this working class neighborhood of 15,000 just lost its economic reason for being. The population ultimately dwindled to about 4,000. And it was at that point that Ms. Davis emerged as a strong voice for building a local economy. And she surveyed her neighbors in terms of what kinds of things they were buying. She tried to identify ways in which local entrepreneurs could be given incentives to meet those commercial needs. And then ultimately she realized that, you know, a comprehensive plan was sort of what was needed. And that neighborhood has now gone through several of those processes. But along the way, they've achieved what few low-income communities of color in older industrial cities have achieved, which is a stabilization of their population, the generation of new businesses, the construction of several hundred high-quality, new, affordable homes, a new school, a public Central Park, all through the inspiration and hard work and dogged determination of these women and the network of neighborhood associations and faith-based groups that they pulled together, and outside allies who got inspired by their willingness to do the impossible with very little.
So they reached out for the state representative, reached out mm-hmm. for the university. You ended up, you know, new man on the totem pole going down there. So when you and the students first drove a van down to see Miss Davis and her neighborhood. What were you looking at? What were the students' reactions? What was that first sort of, I mean, obviously there's some successes at the end of the story, but let us walk in your shoes for a minute here. What was it like?
Well, driving down from the campus, it was a three-hour ride. There was lots of energy, the beginning of a new semester. I was a new professor, lots of conversation, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, we got to the Bluffs, and we headed down in the Mississippi Valley, and you were immediately hit by acrid smoke. There were tires burning uncontrolled in parts of the city. A third of all the houses were vacant. There were no street signs. The city had been out of money for so long, and the place was so poor, people would steal the street signs, also manhole covers. The neighborhood we were assigned to work in with Miss Davis, there were 95 manhole covers missing. People took them for salvage value so that they could make it to the end of the month. So as we pulled up in front of the settlement house, you could hear a pin drop. Our students are looking at vacant buildings, vacant lots, lots of illegal dump sites, active drug dealing on several corners just in the short distance we were in the neighborhood off of the interstate. And one fellow who went on to become one of the senior housing officials in Chicago, young student Rich Koenig, turned to me and said, just what the hell can we do in this situation? It just looks hopeless. And at that point, thankfully, the door opened. We were at the settlement house, and Miss Davis then welcomed us all to Emerson Park, brought us into her classroom. We met this group of women. We called them the Blue Hair Brigades. They were a little up there in age, but they had energy. They had commitment, an amazing knowledge of the neighborhood, wonderful sense of humor. We spent an hour and a half with them. They talked about their hopes and aspirations for the neighborhood. At that point, you could have asked the students to go through a brick wall. They were
there, so...
Yeah, they were taken.
We're talking to Ken Reardon about his new book, Building Bridges, Community and University Partnerships in East St. Louis, that is excerpted in the current issue of Social Policy. So, Ken, I think it goes without saying, and you've almost said it, this was a largely African-American community facing deindustrialization, everything else. And your students were largely white, or there were certainly some differences here. How did that all get shaken out?
Well, the first semester, it was overwhelmingly white, but the word quickly got out within the School of Fine and Applied Arts that there was something interesting happening, that we were, unlike most planners who go into a community and impose their view, we were working in a community where local leadership was so strong under Miss Davis and this network of women that they were really setting the agenda. And we were trying as best we could to provide them with the support, sort of like a pit crew in a race car team, to get where they wanted to go. And so we started attracting African-American, Latino, Latina students to participate. It became one of the most racially diverse studios in the urban planning, architecture, and landscape programs at Illinois.
Ms. Davis was experienced with people coming into the community, and Cleola Davis, from reading the book, was no liberal. So in organizing, we call some of what she did testing. So there's actually quite a lot of testing in the beginning about making sure y'all were different than others, right?
Well, we first got there, our very first meeting, she brought us into a conference room and then showed us three boxes. And on the side of the boxes, it said 1960, 1970, and 1980. And what was inside these milk containers were all the reports my university had done and gotten paid to do, studying how miserable things were in River City. And on the side, it had how many millions of dollars we got to document poverty. And she said, the bad news is that none of the proposals in these boxes containing these reports for three decades had ever been implemented. So the bad news is we've gotten a lot of, quote-unquote, help from the university, which hasn't really translated into any meaningful improvement in the quality of life. So the good news is that there's a different way of doing this work, and she's laid out sort of five principles. One, the residents decide, not the university, faculty, or their funders, what the projects are going to be done. Two, residents participate in every step of the process. Three, don't even bother showing up here unless you're willing to make a five-year commitment, because she realized how long it would take to get the traction behind some of these projects. Four, they wanted any external funding effort by the university to be split 50-50 with the community so that local capacity could be built. And lastly, she wanted us to help her build an independent nonprofit organization to implement plans so that after the university's interest in East St. Louis had waned, that they would have an institution to carry on the work. And I don't know of any other community-university partnership starting in other places where a local indigenous leadership group like Ms. Davis's committee laid out those kinds of organizing principles, saying, this is the deal. The old way of doing business hasn't served us well. We've been victimized by it, and we have a different approach. So I have to go back.
This is an approach that the university and y'all were comfortable with?
Well, I mean, I totally understood, having looked at these boxes of reports and the amount of money and the number of people who had been interviewed repeatedly but with no positive implementation, why they have these strong principles. But bringing it back into the university environment where, you know, the university wants to be in control. Many people, including myself, chose to be professors because we couldn't work for anybody. And all of a sudden, we were going to be held accountable to strong leadership in a low-income community of color. Most of the faculty, all of them at that point, with the exception of one, were Caucasians. And they were basically, if they were signing up to work on this project, they were signing up basically to work under the leadership and management of a low-income group of black women from a city that had been demonized for 40 years. So it was a little different experience. And luckily, there were some terrific faculty across other departments, many of whom came out of old social justice families influenced by church values or the civil rights movement or the student movement, who said, yeah, we need to do something different. What else is working? So we've got buy-in, and the university stayed as the primary partner in East St. Louis from 1990 through 2007, continues to do projects while the overall management of the partnership has now been moved to the local regional university, Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville.
And so universities are used to just keeping the money, and they take, you know, their handling charge or 20% or whatever. So this must have been caused quite a lot of discussion when it started. But one project led to another from what reading your book. So how many communities did y'all end up working with while you were there that first decade?
Six different neighborhoods. So, you know, it was so out of the experience of these community residents that anything would come out of a planning process. And all of a sudden, rumor got, you know, the network started to fly locally that, gee, in Emerson Park, where these folks are working with the university, lots are being cleaned up, houses are being rehabbed, a farmer's market has been built and created. They're actually building new infill housing, all out of this thing called planning. And so other neighborhoods began to approach Ms. Davis, and she strongly encouraged. She believed that we needed to create a multi-neighborhood organization that ultimately could bring together a reform agenda to change citywide policy and run candidates on that agenda. And that's ultimately what happened. And it was very much in the spirit and actually tradition of ACORN, where neighborhood chapters got formed through the neighborhood planning process and the implementation. They then came together to form a group called East St. Louis Community Action Network. And within a year, that group, which laid out clear principles for a new economy in East St. Louis, one that was equitable and just, ran a slate of candidates for East St. Louis City Council. And for the first time in 80 years, candidates which were not endorsed by the St. Clair County machine beat the machine candidates, all out of this network.
Well, and East St. Louis had a fairly effective and dominant machine, and Y'all had a run-in with him. I don't know if it was before or after that election, but that tide rolled all the way back to Champaign-Urbana and threatened, you know, livelihoods and everything else. That's the story that's very telling that we excerpted in Social Policy. Why don't you give us some sense of what happened there?
Sure. As we began to build enough political support and had a clear program, and then funders, which had backed away from East St. Louis, began to consider re-engaging, started giving grants to our community partners. Well, as soon as money showed up, members of the local machine who were connected with the St. Clair County Democratic Organization, through their influence with the mayor, basically asked that we go and meet with them to discuss having one of their organizations, a front organization, serve as the financial agent for a major arts and community development grant that we got. And they had no capacity. They were going to provide no added value to the project. And we already had a spectacular community partner that was going to be the financial agent, which was the Catherine Dunham Center for Arts and Humanities, run by the great dancer, choreographer, civil rights leader, Catherine Dunham. And these corrupt forces wanted us to set aside Ms. Dunham and her organization and instead run the grant through them. And, you know, you can't really fight reform by going to bed with the enemy. So they, in very unvarnished, blunt terms, basically said, if you either run the grant, the university, they were talking to me, through our organization rather than Ms. Dunham's, otherwise there will be problems. And they were very explicit. They said, you're a young professor without tenure, and we understand it's hard to get tenure if there's controversy connected to your work. And if you don't do this, there'll be plenty. So,
well, I said, one of the ironies there, though, I don't want to miss this part of the story as we get into the weeds here, is that you were being counseled by one of your former students who was in part of the first cohort on the project and was then working as, what, city manager or some city official, that it probably made more sense for you all just to take the money and pay the bill and be on with it.
Yeah,
did I misread that?
No. This fellow was the special assistant to the mayor. He ultimately became the city manager, and he said, listen, paying these guys 20 or 25% of the grant amount is a small price to pay that will allow you to move forward. Without it, there are going to be big problems. I have to admit that
he told the truth.
He told the truth. And I...
But he was of the old go-along to get-along was his advice, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, he understood in ways that I didn't at that point that these guys had a big reach. So, you know, we forgot about it. We told them to drop dead, basically, politely.
Well, and the original state representative who'd been, you know, really sort of the initial trigger to make this project happen sort of sold you out too, didn't she?
Absolutely, and we completely were caught by surprise. So 6 months later, I get called into the chancellor's office and said there's a complaint from East St. Louis. I was, you know, completely prepared for that. But the complaint was in the form of a resolution that had been passed overwhelmingly by the Illinois State Black Caucus, that local folks had gone through their state legislators, and they got a resolution basically identifying me as a racist and somebody who was undermining indigenous community organizing in East St. Louis. And this, of course, was a problem. There was a formal review at the university, and it was right at the point where I was up for tenure. So it was, the stakes were high, and I never imagined in my naivete when this former student of mine said, these guys have a big reach. They did.
Amen. Right into your back pocket there and your support. So what then happened? I mean, as I say, I've read the story 6 times now, but it came to sort of a Darwin Scopes trial at the university, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, thankfully the project that was a target of criticism had been carried out by three remarkable folks who've gone on to do terrific things, and they were insanely compulsive in their detail, attention to detail. So we had all the sign-in sheets. We had video of all the meetings. And their assertion was that we had excluded organized black voice from the project. And we had overwhelming documentation. But that might not have been enough.
Including people who were signing the complaint who had signed the Senate sheet that they'd been there.
Right.
And meetings.
We had them in video that making long speeches. We highlighted in the document, because it was a plan, ideas that they had proposed in their video clips, that it actually was incorporated into the plan. It had nothing to do with that. It was all about money. And, you know, we made, a compelling defense, but I don't know if that would have been enough. Ultimately, what turned the tide for us, because you had the state representative who was powerful enough in East St. Louis to get the university to commit to this project. She was signing the complaint. But on the other side of the ledger was a three-page handwritten letter from Catherine Dunham explaining the nature of this conflict and providing complete and enthusiastic support for the project. And that ultimately carried the day.
And there's a happy ending here, but part of the moral is East University of the whole book and your work is these community university partnerships are hard. Do you see more of them happening now? Is there a lot of interest in this? I mean, how are we going to get this message of the book out there, Ken?
Well, there is an enormous amount of student interest and younger faculty interest in this community university partnership model. There's a national organization, Campus Compact, which is promoting this work. Sadly, one of the problems is that it requires faculty to be trained in a much more democratic approach to working with community groups. And many of the folks who've had the most experience doing that are aging out. The 1960s activist generation of professors are retiring. And most mainstream universities train their faculty to work in a top-down fashion. So the biggest question really is, how do we create a new kind of a training institute for faculty who want to undertake this work? And I think there is considerable funding support for projects like this that are willing to make long-term commitments to working on collaborative planning.
But one of the problems you cite, too, is that difficulty of educating the institutions so that professors end up with tenure.
Well, sure. I mean, the typical measure of whether or not a faculty member at the end of 6 years gets permanent employment status is the number of pages he or she publishes in journals, many of which have the most minute readership, have very little impact on our thinking and political and social and cultural life, versus a young faculty member who might engage in a report for a community group that results in congressional testimony that moves the dial on an important policy issue. That's not counted as serious scholarly work. Yet, when you think about what the role of the university should be, that it should be valued. So that's a struggle for young faculty.
Well, and we've learned, whether it's East St. Louis or the work that we did with you and so many of your colleagues in the Ninth Ward here in New Orleans, that after Katrina, there still remains a lot of opposition to anybody from the outside, whether it's New Orleans or East St. Louis or anywhere else, isn't there?
Yeah, most of the experience of, you know, grassroots leaders, of course, as you're so familiar with outside allies, is that they're fair weather friends, that when things are going good and there's a lot of positive publicity and funding, your outside ally, often from the university, will be there. But when the first wave comes over the front of the boat, they often jump out the back and wish their community partners good luck. And
Dan, I have to let people know how to get your book. How can they get your book? I know it's at Social Policy Press and Amazon. This is Building Bridges Community University Partnerships in East St. Louis. But if people want to do these partnerships, is there a way for them to reach you, get some advice, get some copies of the book, whatever?
Absolutely. So you've indicated they can most directly get the book from socialpolicypress.org and order it directly using any payment method. It's also available through Amazon.com. And so those are two good sources. If they're interested in the issues and topics we've talked on, they can also contact me directly. Just Ken Reardon at UMass Boston. Get to our website, and you can make easy contact with me. And then my email is my first name, Kenneth.Reardon, R-E-A-R-D-O-N, at UMB for UMass Boston. edu, and I'd be delighted to hear from anybody, positive or negative. I think this is important.
This has been Race World for another week. Thank you, Ken. The world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.